Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly.
It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from the Times. Yes, I'm back. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. And you know what? I hope you all appreciate that in my absence, I left you in the very capable hands of Alison Rudd, who joins us today in the studio, rather, of course, than Max Rushton, given the bevy of complaints we'd had last time around about his obscenities. Also in the studio with us are Matt Hughes, who has a very large digital watch. Is that...
It's a Garmin Forerunner. It's GPS watch.
Garmin Forerunner. You know Garmin can track your movement. So
but that's the point of it, Gab. That's what GPS means.
No. I don't mean like they know where you are at all times.
They spy on you, Garmin.
And they pass on dossiers to Christopher. That's where Christopher Steele got most of his information from. From Garmin.
Okay. I have a little to hide.
All right. Let's hope so. And it's Julian Lawrence also with us. We'll be talking about the blockbuster weekend in the Premier League, the tradition that goes on for years and years, the big Merseyside versus Manchester showdown. How fantastic was it? Everton fans and Liverpool fans putting their differences aside for one weekend, as traditionally as they've done for the past century, to go and support their city against Manchester. We're going to start, of course, at Old Trafford. And it's a special treat because we have somebody who was at Old Trafford yesterday. Joining us down the line is James Scowcroft. We're going to find out in a minute if he's happy or if he's sad. But, Hughesy, I'm going to start with you. And it kind of struck me that this was kind of a glass-half-full game for both managers. Apart from the result, there was a lot of positives given the circumstances to take away.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, Liverpool had injury problems. Matip couldn't play. Mane still away.
Klein.
But they had a game plan, played really well for sort of probably 50-60 minutes, and were probably slightly disappointed not to win the game. Having said that, United recovered well. Bringing Fellaini on made a difference in terms of substance, if not style. Draw was probably just about the fair result.
Scully, you're at Old Trafford. It's my understanding you didn't actually leave last night. I wanted to ask about Paul Pogba's performance. On Sky, they seem kind of obsessed to pointing out his faults and marking on set pieces. On BBC, on my match of the day, it was more sort of a generic, turgid performance for him on the day of the hashtag and the emoji. Was this just a really bad day at the office? Should they be giving credit to Liverpool? How did you see his game?
He had his poorest game that he's had in the last couple of months. To be fair to him, he's been phenomenal in the last 2 months. He's literally been the driving force behind United's very, very good run. I think it's unfair to single him out yesterday. I think a lot of players were below par. I thought in midfield, basically in the last couple of months, Carrick, Kiera, Pogba, they've sort of made that midfield themselves, and all three of them were poor. They never really sort of stamped their authority on the game. There's a lot of unforced errors, which was unlike all three of them, really. But, you know, I think with his price tag, he'll always get singled out.
Is there such a thing as an unforced error against Liverpool, though? I mean, Liverpool, it's part of what they do now. They make you make errors, don't they?
You can say that, Alison, but I think what happened, there was a lot of anxiety in the second half with United a goal down, you know, people getting a little bit edgy. Just wayward passes when there was nobody near. Hierro especially, you know, gave the ball away, kicked it out of play when he tried to switch play a few times. I wouldn't say that's down to Liverpool because Liverpool weren't anywhere near him. I thought Liverpool were a little bit more fluent in midfield. Their rotation was better in midfield than Manchester United's was. And I think overall a fair result, but United did have chances. They had far more chances than what Liverpool did.
I want to ask you a specific technical question because you've probably marked on corner kicks more often than any of us, or at a higher level anyway than any of us. This business, this Pogba-Lovren business, where I know Lovren's good in the air, but all of a sudden, like when there were, it seemed as if he turned into some combination of Andy Carroll and Godzilla. And was Pogba doing things incorrectly in marking him on the corner, or was it a case that Liverpool actually quietly put together a really, really good set piece routine aimed at, you know, blocking markers and getting people free?
It was a catalogue of errors, really. I haven't seen Liverpool in previous games, but I think the United scout that's watched him, if he's missed that in previous games, then that's a big concern.
Who is it? Name and shame.
I don't know. I've got.
Oh, come on, you know.
First idea, I do not know, Gab.
I bet Andy Mitten would know.
I shall ring Andy up later and find out. Lovren sort of did a block, didn't he, and spun round the back and had a warning sign. I'm not sure why Pogba, of all the players in that team, I would have Pogba marking, but I wouldn't have him as one of the number one markers. I think Lovren was the main target, so maybe Rocco or Jones, the centre-half, would have been better than him. Even Ibrahimovic, I think, at attacking the ball than Pogba. The movement lost him, basically, and he was all over the place. And I think, you know, he's still a young lad. He's still got a lot to learn in you know, defending corners and set pieces like that. Comes with experience.
Julian, when I had my sit-down with Pogba, he said that, you know, the area of his game that he most needs to improve is his heading, both defensive and attacking. He says it's crazy that somebody as tall and as strong as I am doesn't score more goals with his head. And Mourinho afterwards seemed to sort of, you know, complain and kind of point out that, well, you know, we don't have that many tall players or players who are good in the air, and that's why he brought in Fellaini, whatever. Pogba really shouldn't be marking Lovren, right?
No, maybe not. Maybe not. Although you want to give the big responsibility to your, you know, best players. And I think that's why maybe usually...
Why would you want to do that? That's silly. Would you want Alexis Sanchez marking...
But players like Pogba, defensive players, I mean, not anyone. But I think that... So I don't think...
Okay, would you want Hector Bellerin? Sorry, I'm going to be pedantic here, marking Pogba.
But like, if you think about tall players at United who could have taken Lovren, it was, I believe, either Ibra or Pogba. I don't think Jones and Rojo were already probably marking Clavin and I can't remember. I looked at it yesterday. I can't remember who.
Well, that's
Jones
what I mean.
Was on, but
I don't think it's wrong. It's not
that
like
Pogba
you're playing Pulis's Stoke here.
No, but
you know,
still, right? I don't think it's wrong that Pogba is marking Lovren. But he should have done better. But he's not good at it, and he has to improve it.
One of the subplots here, Alison, was Liverpool. With all their absences, I thought, right, there's no way they're going to be able to press and play their game because Alexander-Arnold obviously not going to have the same energy as Klein. Henderson was not 100%. I mean, he's just coming back from, I mean, he was in doubt, I think, until the day before. And yet they did, and I thought a lot of it was down to prodigious performance from a player I suspect you like a little bit, Adam Lallana, who took Carrick out of the game. And then Mourinho responded to that with a bit of tactics of his own, didn't he? By removing him and setting on Rooney.
Rooney played quite well. His finishing was poor, but he added a bit of energy. I mean, that's the problem when you face Liverpool. You've got to somehow deal with their energy. It's not just physical energy; it's attitude of mind in a way. Because you'll get someone like Lallana, who we've praised for most of the season for his delicacy and vision. And his increased output in terms of getting goals, and he was prepared to subdue that side of his game just to be
the
suffocator,
spoiler.
Just to be a suffocator, really.
He was basically what, remember Park Ji-sung at the end of Fergie used him a bunch of times, sort of in that role to go and impress the opposing deep lying playmaker. I thought that was kind of what, you know, when to have a high energy thing and try to drag him out of position. I thought he did that extremely well.
Yeah, another reason to praise Lallana, that he will do that for the team. I think that's astonishing, because I think when I saw the two lineups, I thought Liverpool are weaker here. They're going to struggle.
Scully, given how good United have performed when Carrick's been in there, is this a recipe lesser teams could use? Just basically go and just plant somebody on Carrick and just harass him? Because there's no There's no real alternative to Carrick in the in Mourinho's squad, is there?
They can do, and the reason why they can do is because United don't have a great deal of pace up front as well. So if you go and press high and you expose yourself at the back with spacing behind your back four, it's not that much of a problem because Ibrahimovic is never going to run in behind and threaten your back four. So you can, and Liverpool did do it well yesterday, you can push onto United and do that. If it was a Rashford or a Martial down the middle, you might leave yourself a little bit exposed. But you know, people have tried to do it. You know, Michael Carrick plays very, very deep. It's just whether you want to take a player out of your shape, out of your midfield, to go that high up the pitch and mark him, really. It is a gamble. It was a gamble that probably paid off for Liverpool yesterday.
I think you're right. I think it worked yesterday, but I don't think we should sort of underestimate how difficult it is to play that style that Liverpool played yesterday. It's not just about putting a man on Carrick. All Liverpool's front four were working with incredible sort of speed, stamina and concentration to press really high up the pitch. And there's only really Tottenham and Liverpool, I think, who could probably do that in the Premier League. So it's not as simple as, like, man-marking. Carrick's not in the game. I think it requires a lot more than that.
And what Liverpool did well, especially first half, you got the full-backs high up the pitch as well. James Milner was very high. The other lad, Arnold, as well, was high. So they sort of made a bit of an overload in midfield, which United struggled to deal with.
I got the sense Mourinho after the game sort of almost seemed to allude to the fact that United ran out of time, that they, you know, in the end they created a whole bunch of chances and they really could have easily scored and won it, but then the final whistle came. Do you agree with his assessment?
Well, of course he says that, but it's simply not true. I mean, that there's a final added minutes. Honestly, okay, I'm slightly biased, but who did we think was more likely to score? I mean, really? Really,
if Wijnaldum
could score, if he could shoot, that would be good.
Well, Mignolet made some big saves too, right?
He did, but it didn't feel like the tide had turned because Fellaini's on the pitch.
Let's get the opinion of a United fan.
It's all going United's way. It was pretty to and fro, but I didn't feel if there was an extra 10 minutes added that it was United to win.
Scully, do you agree with?
Yeah, I'd probably back Alisson up on that. Really, I think it. It, you know, Liverpool did. They did come out. I think they you could see they were very disappointed to concede the equaliser as well. And I think the last 5 or 6 minutes, especially the last 4 or 5 minutes of injury time, they did try and take the game to United. I think the game petered out. A 1-1 was a fair score. I don't think anybody from either side could argue against that.
Hughesy, what's more likely at this stage, United making top four or Liverpool winning the Premier League?
Ooh, good question. Ooh.
I'll be throwing it to all of you, so you guys prepare. I just went to Hughesy first because he's probably more educated than the rest of you.
That's not true. But
didn't you go to a fancier university than these people?
No idea. I don't think either of those things will happen.
Oh, good answer.
But I'm not
really
going to give you probability.
You don't think United will finish top four?
No.
And you don't think Liverpool? Okay.
Correct.
Alison?
I think that evens. Is that the right phrase? No, that's wrong, isn't it? I don't know how to do betting. I think that both is likely as each other.
But are they going to happen?
Yeah.
Both will happen.
Oh, yeah.
What? All right. It's positive, yeah. Power of positive thinking. Julian?
The more likely, I say, would be Liverpool winning the title, but I'm with Hughesy on that. None
you think Liverpool winning the title?
Is more likely
They're
than
seven
United.
Points back.
But,
more
none
likely.
Of them is going to happen. Neither of them is going to happen.
Scully, this lack of faith in Jose. United are 3 points away from qualifying for the Champions League. Liverpool are 7 points behind Chelsea.
I totally agree with you, Gab.
What?
I totally agree with you. I can't see Liverpool winning the league. I think United are probably 50-50 to finish in the top four. Manchester United haven't got to play one of the big teams now until mid-April. So they've got a really good run of games coming up now.
Somebody hit me up on Twitter and told me, like, can you talk a little bit about Everton too? And I said, and so we're going to start actually talking about Everton. Because the first time I saw Tom Davies in the flesh, he was totally fresh-faced, sort of, you know, the kind of like that baby skin. He had the same haircut that Alisson has now. In fact, he kind of looked like he could be related to Alisson somehow, if not for the fact that he's a blue, of course. I'm still mesmerized by the run, and maybe I'm being a little bit too romantic here, but goodness, like, you're taking on Yaya Toure and Gael Clichy. And I thought, you know, have some respect. And he goes and he does that move. And then plays the 1-2. And then he runs into Stones, who probably is like 20 pounds heavier than he is. He gets knocked over. He gets up again. And then he finishes. That was awesome.
And he's the 79th minute. If you do that after 15 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour, but he's run for 80 minutes like a, you know, like a headless chicken. And then at the end, he has the lucidity of doing that little shit of a Bravo that goes in. And I'm so glad Lukaku didn't steal the goal, by the way. But fantastic. And we picked him up. Do you remember? We said he looked very, very good. I think after the Chelsea game, maybe he came on. And it was a disastrous day for Everton.
No, was it that? I think we just talked about him because he looked funny with
no,
with
I'm
the
sure
hair.
We picked him up. We said he had a bright future.
Yeah, we did. We definitely said. Yeah. Look for him. He's going to score against City, we said. I think we definitely said that.
Really, listen to all the podcasts. So you'll find it.
The other guy I liked was Mason Holgate. And I saw him earlier this year. And he seems like super mature.
He was at Barnsley. The thing about Everton is the academy is obviously very, very good. And Davis is a pure product of the academy, so is Rooney and Barkley and all of that. But they're also very good at finding those youngsters from other clubs, like Holgate at Barnsley, Stones is Barnsley as well, Calvert-Lewin, who came from Sheffield United in the summer as well. And then it's not just buying a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old and then make him sit on the bench or train nine again with the first team. He's developing him as well with the reserves, but also with the first team, and then being able to have those kind of performances in games like
of
this
course,
one.
Ademola Lookman, another guy they got from another club, from Charlton, if memory serves.
Only a few weeks ago, yeah.
When it doesn't work out for Koeman, we criticize him when he goes and he sort of mega parks the bus. But when it does work out and they're devastating on the counter like this one, we praise him, right? But it's the same guy.
I've never criticized him. I don't know what you're
talking about. No, you love him. You absolutely love him.
You love him more than many people at Everton. Because despite this result, he's not universally popular from what I'm told. I don't think he really wants to be, but he's
why? Is it the football?
He's kind of a... He can play good football too.
More
of his personality, really, I think. He's kind of pretty Marmite-y.
Yeah.
You're either in his team or you're not, and he makes his mind up pretty quickly. He doesn't hide the way he feels about things, and he's not a diplomat, which I think rubs people up the wrong way and can create problems with certain players. I mean, the Barkley issue is sort of
that's
ongoing.
That's a good illustration of why he doesn't make his mind up pretty quickly. I mean, he had problems with Barkley, and any manager would have done. He's a frustrating player because he's clearly got the talent and wasn't quite fit enough. And yet he was in this starting lineup and an important cog in the machine. And he hasn't pushed him out into the shadows and said, go and train in some foreign country's boot camp for 6 months. He's brought him back in. So he is adaptable.
He is adaptable. I think he's a good manager. I just look at his whole career, really, and he's streaky. You know, he's either very good or very bad. He struggled for consistency. And it'll be interesting to see if he can do that, Evan, because they started very well, then have dipped, and they've pulled off eye-catching results like this one. But then there'll be some home games that they look very, very poor.
I have a provocative question for y'all. If the guy who's maybe Everton's best defensive midfielder, maybe the best defensive midfielder not named N'Golo in the Premier League, if he'd been available, would they have... Would Tom Davies have played and would they have won this game?
It brings something different.
I'm talking about Gay, by the way, in case you hadn't caught it.
I want to believe that he saw in Davis someone who would run forever and who would be able to run a Yaya Toure even in the 79th minute and then create something so you play him, because he would have always been that threat for City, which Barry and Gay wouldn't have been, because they're not those type of runners at all.
Should we talk City? So Pep has conceded the title. He doesn't think they're going to win the Premier League this year. Is he right?
Yeah.
But
is it a clever thing to say to kind of... Because I'm thinking of like last year and the lame duck manager type thing, and to come out and say that, is there a risk that you then get into some kind of weirdo comfort zone, you focus everything on the Champions League until you get knocked out and you don't really progress as a team?
I don't think so, because he's in a far stronger position than Pellegrini. He's in the first year of his contract. City have spent 5 years trying to get him to the club. For all the sort of hysteria in English football, there's no way that Pep Guardiola is getting sacked this season. So he knows that if those players want to stay at the club, they're going to have to improve. He knows he's going to change, and he's going to have to kind of, you know, perhaps be a bit more pragmatic and accept that having weaknesses in both penalty boxes is actually quite a bad thing.
We've all taken the line, everybody in the media, talking about how Pep is giving up on the title. But it's weird because he gave an interview, I think it was in Spain, maybe,
when I was at Barcelona as a player, at one point we were 12 points behind Real Madrid, and we came back, we won the title, so we're not giving up. Which seems to totally... I'm just wondering if maybe he either says different things to different people, or maybe this is another situation where he just kind of talks without thinking and his words get misinterpreted. I mean, are we 100% sure that this is what he means?
I think he's low. I think he's... Yeah. I don't want to use the word depressed because that's a medical clinical term. But he seems low.
I don't think
he'll get sacked. I think he'll walk away. I don't think he's enjoying himself one bit.
I saw him being interviewed, and I suppose obviously they do different ones. There's a Sky one, there's a BBC one, there's a World Feed one. Where he's like rocking back and forth while he's talking, and he looks like, you know, like a kid who has to go and pee or something. And yeah, he's not.
That's what bears do in the zoo. and it's how you know a bear's unhappy being in a cage, because they rock back and forth.
I'll give you the other side, though, to back up what Pep said, Julian, which is that City could have put this game away easily. And in the end, Everton take 4 shots on target and scores 4 goals. And this is football. And Raheem Sterling should have had a penalty. And if they score the penalty, then Everton have to come forward. And then it's easy pickings. And Aguero scores a hat trick. And all of a sudden, we're not talking about Pep as a bear in a cage, Allison, but we're talking about how brilliant... How City are back and how brilliant they are and what a fantastic title race we have.
True, but it has happened so many times this season that it just can't be an accident anymore. You know, it can happen once or twice where you feel you're really unlucky because it didn't work out for you with your chances and the other team had one chance and scored 2 goals or something like that. But it's happened again and again and again. There must be other issues than just, well, you know... Like you said, they arrived once, they scored, they arrived twice, they scored again. Maybe it was too easy for them to score, and it certainly was. And it's an issue because you can let the opposition create chances, but if you make sure that it's hard for them to score them, they won't have 4 shots on target and 4 goals.
That defence has got worse this season.
I don't understand. It's the 16th of January. They're one of the richest clubs in the world, if not the richest. How on earth is it possible they haven't signed anyone?
Well,
they don't know this is, at the Etihad, it's a transfer window.
This is, I think, a really big issue. So I don't know if you put the blame on Pep or if you put it on Chiki Begiristein, but if you look at this is really, really bad. They go and they spend, what, like a combined 70, 75 million on Leroy Sané and Gabriel Jesus on the summer. Now, I'm not saying that they're bad signings and, you know, they're both very promising youngsters, but they're people who don't get on the pitch. Right? I mean, Jesus we haven't seen yet.
He's not qualified.
He just arrived?
Yeah.
He's not qualified. They haven't registered him yet?
No. Right, so he couldn't even have been on the bench yesterday.
And Sané's just played really, really little. And it doesn't feel like he's somebody necessarily needed because they've got a lot of attacking players. And they do this and they don't upgrade defensive midfield or indeed defense, despite the fact that they know that, you know, going the whole season with 3 center backs is tough, and then when one of them is Vincent Kompany, who's got his injury record situation, I just find that completely bizarre. Before weaving into the Bravo Heart thing, I want to know. I want you to tell me, Husey, because you're best placed. Is this Pep or is this Cheeky?
You think it was Pep? I mean,
I would think it's Pep too. I'm wondering:
see the squad and say like, yeah, that's good enough, surely.
Yeah, but good enough for what?
Good enough to do well. He can't look at his squad and say, yeah, I'm going to play Zabaleta in midfield because that's great. Because I did it with Lam and he worked, so he's going to work with Zabaleta. Zabaleta is not Philip Lam. It's not going to work. It's not working.
He's clearly overrated his own ability to improve players.
Yeah, maybe that's
a good point. Was that what he was thinking? Like, I'm going to improve Zabaleta? Because it's not like Zabaleta and Sanya and Clichy. It's not like these guys are 20 years old.
No,
yeah, exactly.
You're improving people with expiring contract.
Not only is he attempting to improve them, he's attempting to reinvent them, which is even harder. You know, by playing them in different positions, playing Kolarov at centre
but
half.
But I go back to this: what do we expect from a director of football? I mean, Chiki Begiristein is not, you know, some Burke. He's a guy who won a lot of things at Barcelona. He's a guy who's known Pep for a very long time. I'm thinking if I'm Khaldun, if I'm the guy who hires these people, you know. I say, guys, I know, Pep, that you're God, but it is a two-way relationship. I mean, that's the way it should work.
He did win a lot of things at Barcelona, but what was his record in the transfer market like? Both Pep's and Begiristein's. I mean, most of those players...
Okay, Chigrinsky, Karras...
No, I know. ...were kind of there, weren't they? and he got the best out of it.
No, but what I'm saying is people also learn from their mistakes. They learn from their past. I mean, in the same way...
Sure, but what is the evidence that suggests that Bagheera Stein can put together a new football team, which is clearly what needs to happen?
I think the evidence is that he played football for a long time. He's been in the game for a long time. And in the same way that... And I guess this is what I'm driving at. The same way that conventional wisdom, right, would tell us that Zabaleta is not Dani Alves, that these guys are old, that it's not a good idea to wait until the end to decide that art's not good enough and blah, 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 that you're shorthanded, that company's always hurt, that Pep's not going to like Delph for whatever reason, or he's not going to be fit. I mean, that guy was on the bench again, right? Especially when you know Pep inside out the way Bagheera Stein does, I would imagine that you'd have at least some level of dialogue where Bagheera Stein says, sorry, Pep, I know you've got a wider vision and you see football differently than I do, but, you know, just as a layman here, why are we doing this? Shouldn't we be doing that? Why are we spending all this money on Sané when you're not going to get him on the pitch because there's other guys you like?
They might have that chat. They might disagree. They might disagree. Pep might not want any signings, and Chiki is going like, listen, we need another easily two centre. When, do you remember in the summer we said that three-quarters of that squad needs... out and new in and new players in. Well, it's quite obvious, and yesterday was very obvious that of that starting 11, who should be there really in that City team? Apart from Aguero, De Bruyne, David Silva, everybody else.
Sterling,
okay.
Stormzy. Everybody.
So we my point was playing. Okay, maybe six shouldn't be there. We said that we need at least three transfer windows to make this squad.
Oh, come on, you sound like Duncan Castle's talking about
Mourinho. No. What? You don't believe this squad needs reinforcement?
This really bugs me.
Let me ask you a question first. You don't think this City squad needs improvement?
I said in the summer, right, when I predicted that City were going to finish fifth, and people said, oh, but they've got the best squad in the Premier League. And I said, no, they don't. Okay? And so many people picked City to finish first. So many people talked about the strength of their squad, the strength and depth. And now as if conventional wisdom in the summer was that this was not the case.
I'm with you on that. That's what. Yeah, we shared the same thing. But we said the same thing on the podcast.
We're the only two people saying it.
No. I don't think we are. But why have they wasted 2 weeks already in this transfer window and I've not seen anyone?
It's obstinacy. There's a difference between having a strong philosophy and just being obdurate. Presumably, when they signed, they finally got the god. They got the god they wanted to be manager, and they said, "Can you make what we have work?"
Surely they.
He would have said, "He would have said, of course I can, because I know how to do that. It's about making sure the system comes first, the approach comes first, and I can make. As long as we've got John Stones, we'll be fine." I think Pep thinks if he signs a host of expensive players now, which you can't get now anyway. It's another way of him saying, I judge the Premier League wrong.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to move on to our debate in a minute, but we want to mark the passing of Graham Taylor, the former Watford and England and Aston Villa manager. I had the opportunity to work with him on television on numerous occasions, and what I remember of him, and again, I didn't really cover him, so I had a different experience, was just how enthusiastic he was and how sort of you get excited. You know, you work with ex-pros, we've all done it, there's no ex-pro here, so we think we can say it, and sometimes they go and they just kind of mail it in, they're like, oh, another game, another shift, punching a time card, but it was never like that with Taylor, and he really did love his job and love the sport. You can debate whether he was his place as a manager in the history of English football. Obviously, failing to qualify for a World Cup is pretty bad. Although to be fair, he's not the only England manager to have failed to do that. But I think there's so more, and hopefully that's just like a footnote in his career. Transfer window opens, and all of a sudden we get stories about mercenary superstars wanting moves and developing back issues. Now, for those who don't know, the beauty of a back injury is it's something that no club doctor can scan for. You say it hurts, it hurts. Okay, now I'm just pointing out fact. I'm sure Paya and Diego Costa both suffer terrible backaches right now. We'll get to that in a minute. Husey, you've written about Diego Costa. Let's start with Dimitri Payet because, of course, West Ham once won the World Cup. I'm assuming you have some insight on what's going on, Julien? Just stereotyping on the fact that you're more French than the rest of us?
No, I'm hoping I do. Well, okay, that's the situation. It's pretty clear, although I can see why West Ham fans are going mad, and they're probably right in a way. Dimitri Payet doesn't want to play for the club anymore, doesn't want to be at the club anymore, doesn't even want to live in London anymore. He's not happy here. His wife is not happy. The three children are not happy. The wife and the kids are already in Marseille. They're looking for a house. They're looking for schools. It's quite clear for them that he will leave West Ham and join Marseille. The Marseille directors and people are in London today. They will meet West Ham at some point this week, make another offer. The first one was rejected. West Ham said, we're not going to sell. They really believe that with the highest offer, maybe around the 30 million euros, bonus included, it will happen. It's still a long way. I'm not saying West Ham fans, it will happen. I'm just saying that they are confident in Marseille, and Dimitri Payet is confident as well that it will happen.
By the way, and thanks to Brexit, that means that West Ham will make an even bigger profit.
More money.
Yeah, see?
Than before Brexit. Good on you, the people who voted for Brexit. But
will Marseille pay the wages?
So he's already reached an agreement with Marseille. With Marseille is sorted.
I don't think they will. Money. I've been told that he's taking a pay cut.
Much. A little bit, but not much.
There's I've been told he's taking a substantial Marseille. Pay cut, and that
there's a lot of bonuses.
The makeup is a lot of bonuses, but these aren't the funny like Anthony Martial bonuses, like you know, put on your shoe when you get another million. these are bonuses that actually he may not reach.
Yeah, and I was also told the point is he's happy with it. So if you know he's agreed to it.
Well, I don't know. So, but if that's the case, then can we all agree that we can't call him a greedy mercenary, if he's taking a pay cut?
Oh, yeah, that's, well, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Different to
we can call him unprofessional.
Yeah, it's different than going to China for three or four
but
times your
wages. The crux of it, Julien, is that all makes perfect sense. If your family are not happy, and it's going to affect you as a footballer, if you care for your family, and he's from Marseille, he knows Marseille.
He's not from Marseille. No,
he's from Marseille, where he played a lot of his football. He knows it's a part of his
what
family.
Was it 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah.
The guy comes from like a tropical island, which is the polar opposite of
Marseille. His wife and family Marseille. That's the point. He's not going somewhere brand new and taking a punt somewhere. He's going, effectively, as far as family is concerned, he's going home. Hilarious, Gav. But the point is, why did it reach the point where he has to be so vilified and come out as this anti-hero? Surely the club are slightly at fault for not being able to handle that need to move better.
Yeah, I think the way he's done it is obviously wrong. He's a very stubborn guy.
Why? You know it. Why did he have to do it in that way? He's got a history of pouting, hasn't he?
Exactly.
Why does it escalate from saying, I'm not happy to that?
That's his attitude.
I'm going on strike.
That's his attitude. I think he believed they didn't listen to him. He believed they didn't listen to him in the summer when he already was making a few noises like, we're not happy here. We don't really want to be here. Would you let me go? And from what I was told, West Ham went like did the ostrich policy, as we say in French, which they buried their head in the sand and let the few clubs who were there for Payet and wanted a bit of talk and negotiation with West Ham, they let them go away by not responding. The thing that get people, and especially West Ham fans, mad, and rightly so, is that in February, when he signed his new deal for 5.5 years, for 125k a week, he didn't say to anyone he was not happy in London, that the kids were not happy at school, that the wife was not happy either. He was very happy at the time to sign a huge pay rise in that new contract. So I get all of that, but I think that when they signed a new contract, they thought, okay, let's give it another go because it's working so well on the pitch. It would be silly because we're not happy here because, you know, the language is a problem, the culture is a problem. You know, they felt like that. Let's give it another go and see where that leads us.
Enough Payet. Let's move on to someone who's having a really, really good season. Diego Costa. Hughesy, you have an exclusive in the paper today. Costa rejected $200K offer before bust up.
On Tuesday, Costa was claiming he had a back problem, couldn't train. Chelsea physios, fitness staff weren't convinced. Conte weighed on their side, made him train on his own, didn't travel to Leicester as a result. But bubbling away in the background is this offer he's had from China, apparently about £30 million a year. He stands to earn from a club. I don't even know where it is and can't pronounce it.
It's Tianjin.
Tianjin, where is it?
Well, they're promoted by the guy who captained the 2006 World Cup winning side.
Oh, are they?
Fabio Cannavaro, yeah.
Oh, really? He's their coach?
Yes.
All right.
And they're newly promoted to the Chinese Super League.
Anyway, they've got a lot of money to spend, and Jorge Mendes met them last week and is talking to them about Costa going there. And
Jorge Mendes wants a piece of the Chinese pie, right?
Cause, you think?
Because Kia's getting everything and Jorge is getting all the crumbs.
Whether,
and it's really
whether
funny.
Costa Did you wants think to go or not, or whether he's using it to get a pay rise at Chelsea is unclear. But basically, found out yesterday that Chelsea had already offered him a big improvement on his current contract a couple of weeks ago, and he said no. So I think what will happen is he'll probably be forced to stay, and they'll leave in the summer.
Would it make sense from Chelsea's perspective to call his bluff and say, you know what, if there really is, as Matt Hughes reports, an £80 million offer for him, how about we knock that down to $70 million and we sell you to Tianjin, but you stay here on loan until the summer, or we mathematically win the Premier League, whichever happens first. That way, Diego, you get more money and you get to win another Premier League title. Tianjin, you know he's not going anywhere and we're not going to sell him to Shanghai or somewhere else in the summer, and everybody's happy.
I don't think there's any appetite at Chelsea to make Costa's life easier at the minute. I think
Well, they kind of need to because they went through the summer window, winter transfer window, looking to buy a striker, right? Because
yeah.
Batshuayi is apparently not the alternative to Diego Costa.
No.
And they don't want to be in a situation where they have to buy two strikers, right?
No, but I think Costa's different to play. I don't know him, but many people do. And he's very kind of volatile up and down. I don't think he is a stubborn. One day he can think one thing, the next day he can think the other thing. So I think come February, he's a real, as you can tell from watching him, he's a real competitor. He's not going to want to be not playing football for 6 months.
Do you think his back might improve?
I think his back may improve quite quickly. The issue is whether he signs this new contract at Chelsea and squeezes another £50,000 a week out of them, or if he wants to go to China. No one really seems to know that at the minute. There's sort of mixed messages from the club. Apparently, he's telling the players different things every day.
Would we be in this situation if Jorge Mendes had more influence at Chelsea than if he had the same level of influence at Chelsea that he did in the past?
Yeah, I think because these guys, they don't care. They're not like traditional agents who manage their clients' careers very expertly and very diligently. These guys have got so many clients, they're in their fingers in so many pies, they just want to make money for themselves, basically.
And their clients, of course.
Well, the one leads to the other, yeah.
It's a virtuous cycle of life.
I think a lot of these people don't have their clients' best interests at heart, otherwise they wouldn't. Oscar wouldn't be going to China, would he, if he was interested in his furthering his career?
Yeah, I disagree on that one. I don't think Oscar going to China is that. I mean, he's still in the Brazilian national team.
He's not going to get better, though, is he? He's not going to improve as a footballer.
Going to improve as a Chelsea not playing either.
Well, he could if he learned to work and learned to tackle.
But that's kind of the Ashley Young argument, right? Remember Ashley Young, England footballer? A lot of money, really good. Eddie Boothroyd saying he was the best player in the world.
Louis van Gaal loved him.
Yeah. And he spent his career at a club where he never plays. He could go to a mid-table club, make roughly the same money, maybe a little less, and be an absolute superstar, right? And yet he chooses to go there and, you know, play a walk-on part in the war rather than a lead role in a cage.
Yeah, I don't think that's a particularly good parallel, really, because Young's chosen to, you know, play at a big club, earn money and win titles, whereas Oscar's just chosen to go and earn money and
win title and well, no, but I mean, I think the key thing with Oscar is that Brazil's shown that they keep calling guys from China.
Yeah,
that it's not, you know, he's not holding it against them. You got a World Cup in 2018, maybe, and he's young enough that maybe he can then come back to Europe.
You just described accurately Costa as a real competitor, probably one of the more competitive players we've ever seen in the Premier League in terms of his. You can see in his eyes how competitive he is. Yeah. He's going to be bored out of his brain in China.
One would think he may, because the standard is too terrible. My brother lives
in
Shanghai.
What's the point?
You've got a season ticket,
Shenhua, other than the money, which you can get here.
He says it's awful. It's like worse than League One. Most of them have one or two good, aging European or South American players. But the rest of the team is terrible.
How's your brother finding the pollution? Does he walk around with a little... Does he have one of those pollution monitors in his...
It's not great, but he deals with it.
Because I heard about... I was listening to BBC's from our own correspondent on the way in, and they had an item of a guy who lives in Shanghai, and he has... You can buy these little pollution monitors you put in your house to rate the air quality, and like...
It's definitely worse than Cobham.
There you go. How about some quick hits? Some of us were expecting a knock-on effect from the Tottenham game. Instead, we got a comprehensive hammering of the defending Premier League champions. Hughesy, business as usual for Chelsea?
I thought even better than that, actually. Really good performance, particularly without Costa. And I thought the way that the front three, Hazard, Pedro, Willian, interlinked was outstanding, really, and suggests that that defeat at Spurs was just a one-off and Chelsea can... go back to chalking off the wins every week, enjoying their lovely midweek breaks, and win the league quite easily.
By the way, since you know your way around Chelsea, somebody asked me this. Any shot that, if there are Diego Costa issues, that Tammy Abraham comes back and, no, you're making a face?
Nah, well, they love him, and he's good, but when was the last time Chelsea ever gave a kid a chance? I mean, Patrick Bamford came back on loan last January and never played for them. Has still never played for them. I think Abraham is better.
Tammy Abraham's a beast.
Yeah, but he's playing in a mid to low table championship team. I just can't see that happening.
All right. Arsenal roll over Swansea 4-0 and spoil Paul Clement's debut. Julian, would you rather talk about the umpteenth false dawn for Arsenal or discuss Clement's chances at Swansea?
I'll do both. I think it was a very important win for Arsenal, although a very slow start again, like we mentioned last week, Alisson. But it was very good for them, and they're still there. They're there. They're fourth in the table. They're hanging out, which is good for them. And Paul Clement will have a lot of work to do. But he's called Clement. My brother is called Clement, so I hope he's going to succeed.
Your brother's actually called Clement?
Clement. But it's hard to say in like English way for people in England.
Harry Kane bags a hat-trick and Dele Alli dispenses magic as Tottenham beat up West Brom 4-0. Alisson, are they the best 1-2 punch in the Premier League right now? Or, and I suspect I know the answer to this, would you rather discuss your love and my love for Moussa Dembélé?
They are marvellous, the pair. The last 10 goals have come from those two players, so clearly they are super informed. But as I wrote today in the game, they're only able to play with such freedom and joy because of the role played by Moussa Dembélé, who has become the mature babysitter, if you like, of the team. And when Pochettino joked that Tottenham do not exist without him, it was a joke a year ago, and now I think it's almost true.
The commentariat turned up their nose when Marco Silva was appointed. And it's the usual guys who, the Football 365 does this absolutely brutal takedown of the usual suspect ex-pros who go and moan when foreigners that they've never heard of go and get clubs. They all moaned about Marco Silva being appointed because he wasn't giving an English coach a chance who knows the league. But so far, so good. He's got a great backstory, and he beats Bournemouth 3-1, and it's their first league win since early November. Usually he's young, but he has a bit of a track record. Are you impressed?
I was impressed on Saturday, yeah. It's a good... great start. Hernandez scored a couple of good goals. They look good, and I agree with you about how it's really easy to sneer at kind of foreign guys you've never heard of. I remember when the great Nigel Adkins was sacked at Southampton and some guy called Pochettino was appointed, and the world went crazy about how this was ridiculous. He couldn't even speak English and Southampton were going to get relegated, and he did quite well. So Silva, interesting, you know, any positivity about a left field appointment is slightly in mind when you learn that he's a Mendes client and Hull are trying to sell the club. So there's that
and
part
traffic.
Of it all. Yeah, it's just, you know, it makes you think, is that the reason?
And Quaresma is coming as well.
Is that the reason that he's
Nani, maybe too.
But, you know, it's an interesting appointment. I'd love to know who made the decision.
Sam Allardyce, obviously,
who has so much experience and so he's so good because so English. He's still yet to win at Crystal Palace, where Marco Silva has got more points in one Premier League game than Big Sam in 4 or 5.
The African Cup of Nations kicked off on Saturday, and Julien, I'll ask you about it since you're French and half these nations are francophone. What should the casual fan look out for? And are you on the Côte d'Ivoire bandwagon the way everybody seems to be?
I am, but also I'm on the Algeria and Senegal and all those countries. I think it's a great competition. You will get
all your former colonies.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't matter. I just speak French. But no, you see big stars like Riyad Mahrez.
Notice how he doesn't get excited about Zimbabwe, who nearly stuffed Riyad Mahrez and your Algerian friends.
Wait, you're gonna eat your words. I was saying you get to see big stars like Riyad Mahrez, who scored a lovely goal yesterday. You get to see good young players or players that you didn't know before, like Bilia for Zimbabwe, who played really well yesterday against Algeria as well. You see folklore, you see great atmosphere, you see pitches that not that great often. But I think it's a very interesting one. And kickoffs are in the week, in the afternoon often as well, or late afternoon, early evening. So that's more football on television, and I'm always good for that.
Alison, given that you filled in so admirably last week, much better than Max Rushton would have done, obviously, you get an absolute freebie. Peter Crouch, Andy Carroll, and Jermaine Defoe all scored at the weekend. This is your chance to celebrate England strikers past, and if Tony Cascarino, who said that they ought to be called up to the England team by Gareth Southgate, gets his way, possibly future.
I could watch that Andy Carroll goal over and over again. It is the goal of the season so far. Scorpion kick all you like. There's something incredibly beautiful about it. It's perfect. It's flawless. It's gorgeous. And it proves, and the strikers you've named, Gab, proves that the old adage, class is permanent, form is temporary. And what it means is that someone should take a punt on Dimitar Berbatov. Get him back. Get him scoring too.
That'd be something. By the way, the Carroll goal, did it look better because you have a big, strong man doing it rather than one of those little agile guys?
Because the height of
the height he reaches. But also, you watch your replays. It's supposed to be slow motion. The ball seems to go even faster.
It's so elegant. And you think that it's going to be loopy in some way? And then it goes...
That's fantastic.
Well done, Andy Carroll. Almost kind of between him and Figuli, and do they even need Payet back?
Dimitri who? Exactly. Gab, one for you. We hear that the league leaders in Italy and Spain both lost this weekend. What happens?
Well, what happened?
Have you been taking acting classes?
No.
Say that again.
I was surprised. I didn't know.
What happened
What happened?
After 40 games unbeaten, matching the legendary Brian Clough's streak for Nottingham Forest, Zinedine Zidane lost a game. And he ran into the genius of football, the man who will revolutionize the game as we know it, Jorge Sampaoli, the real deal for Sevilla. Sevilla ran themselves into the ground. Zidane, clearly fearing and respecting Sampaoli, played a back three. When's the last time Real Madrid did that? Probably
never.
Probably never, actually. And I thought they actually maybe a little bit fortunate. They took the lead through a penalty, but then drama, pathos. Sergio Ramos, of course, who's a Sevilla born and bred. When Spain won the World Cup, he and all the Catalan guys were jumping around a Catalan flag, he pulled out an Andalusian flag. I didn't even know what it was, right? And then he heads it into his own net. And this is after a week when he got all sorts of abuse because he scored a late equalizer against Sevilla in the Spanish Cup. And then, just as you think this game's going to end a draw, it's fine. Stefan Jovetic, former Manchester City star, hasn't scored a league goal since April, just arrived on loan. Boom! From distance. Keylor Navas, all those people saying, like, oh, he's better than De Gea. Yeah, right. He's totally out of position. And it's 2-1 for Sevilla, and it's fantastic because you've got Real Madrid now with a one-point lead over Sevilla, 2 points over Juventus. They do have a game in hand, but I was so happy.
Leicester?
No, I'm happy for Leicester because I think Sevilla think they can win the league now. So I think this is going to be a big distraction for them.
Do you fear for the paperback edition?
No, I'm going to do another hardback after they win the Champions League. And Juventus running into Fiorentina, managed by the lovely, in every sense of the word, Paolo Sousa, of course. This is pretty cool because Fiorentina won 2-1
Juventus used to be able to switch from a back three to a back four. They can't do that anymore, or at least not as seamlessly. And it's a great story, Fiorentina as well. They have this player named Federico Chiesa, whose dad was Enrico Chiesa, tremendous striker for Sampdoria and Fiorentina as well. We've got a title race there too. They're 1 point clear of Roma. They also have a game in hand, and 2 points clear of Napoli. So, yeah, title races all around Europe, in France as well. 3 points. You got Nice and Monaco joint at the top, and
yeah, PSG in 3 points behind.
Yeah, in Germany was it 3 points, right? Yeah. Leipzig and Munich. And
title races let's all throw around it Europe. At you, like you throw it at us. What are the chances of Seville winning the title then?
I would say 20%. Because remember, you have Barcelona in there too. They're not really far, not that far. I mean, they've got a raft of issues. And you can read my excellent column about the club's behavior in sacking. Actually, I'm going to talk about this just for 30 seconds, if you may allow, because I know not everybody is behind the paywall. You guys heard what happened? There's this guy, dude, nobody'd ever heard of, well, casual fans. This guy named Perry Graticos. He's basically an old guy. He's an ex-player, former, it was Messi's youth team coach. He's one of those club officials who goes to draws, right? Sits there and watches the guy pulling the balls out, and, you know, whatever. He's asked about Lionel Messi, and he has a temerity to say, oh, Lionel Messi is the best player in the world, but he's got great players around him who make him better, which, I don't know, is that a crazy, unreasonable opinion? The guy gets sacked a few hours later because his opinion, quote, does not coincide with that of the club. I thought it was just so silly and so hypocritical, too, because if the idea wasn't nobody can talk about Messi while he's under contract negotiations, Luis Suarez comes out, and this is after Barcelona's chief executive had said that they're going to use common sense in dealing with Messi. Luis Suarez comes out and says, oh, forget common sense. Just sign him up. That's all you know how to do. Just give him whatever he wants. But, of course, Luis Suarez, even though his opinion doesn't coincide with that of the club either, doesn't get fined or sacked because Luis Suarez is talented at playing football and the other one's just a guy who sits there and watches a man pull balls out of the bag. Anyway, I digress far too much. That's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guest today, James Scowcroft, joining us through the miracle of cellular telephony from Old Trafford, Alison Rudd here in the studio, Julian Lawrence, and Matt Hughes. Remember, if you want to sign up for the paper and read all our excellent copy, it's just £12 for a 12-week trial. All you need to do is search The Times online. Now, please press that subscribe button to subscribe to our podcast. You can do this wherever you choose to download your podcast and leave a review on iTunes if you're listening to an Apple device. Positive reviews only, please. Till next week, bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.